Thanks, Luke. Would you join me in Exodus, the book of Exodus this morning? That is the second book in the Bible. So if you have a paper copy of God's Word, you open the front, you'll find Genesis. You just keep scrolling over or moving over, whichever it is in a paper copy. You'll find Exodus. You can also just Google that, Exodus chapter number 16. We'll go back to Luke, probably starting at some point in January, though we have Sanctity of Life Month issues to discuss there as well. Wanted to end the year with a passage that encourages but also challenges us, not only about what we thought about this last year, but also the year ahead, framing our thoughts biblically, Exodus chapter number 16. Now, last week, many of you maybe are aware, our family contracted something that went through about everybody but Trinity and I. I'm not sure what it was. I'm no doctor. I'm thinking it was the bubonic plague. It's something. I don't know. But I do know this. I've cleaned up enough vomit in 2015 to punch my card for 2016, so my wife is on vomit duty for all of 2016. That's how I feel about it. She may differ. We don't worry about that right now. All right. The amount of texts, though, and calls and check-ins that we received was just incredibly gracious and over the top. There was a text. There was a phone call. There was a Facebook message. There was, a carrier pigeon dropped something. It was great. People just over the top. In fact, somebody was gracious as well last week on Saturday. Sweet family brought dinner and said, whoever can eat, we just want to be a help and a blessing and drop off some food for whoever can eat. Now, one of the younger children had not been puking for a while, and they had graduated to saltine crackers. You guys know the drill, right? And they're keeping those down, and they're doing all right for hours on end. So when it came to dinner, they had a moderate dinner. And the person that brought the food was very kind and brought some of her favorite fruit, which is strawberries. And so she ate the moderate dinner. She ate a few strawberries the rest of the night, doing awesome. But then there's the rest of the story, right? She was doing great, had a great time. But then what did we find the next morning in her bed, on the carpet, down the hallway? But about the most artistic vomit you can imagine, right? She had eaten, but she had not retained, and that was a cleanup situation. Now, what if I said it this way? Let's rewind and act like I hadn't just told you everything about a sweet family, all that. Let's say I opened the sermon this week. Last week, my family ended up sick as could be. I don't know why it was us. It always has to be us. Family trying to be a blessing, or so they thought. Brought us, a puking family, a bunch of food. I mean, how careless and thoughtless is that? On top of that, they brought us something with red in the coloring. I don't know what they were thinking. I don't know. Maybe you know. And guess what happened? One of my children ate too much food, barfed strawberries all over the carpet. The carpet's likely ruined now, all because this one family wanted to be a blessing. Based on shared human experience and reasoning, I think we would all likely agree that if I had led the sermon that way, how unnatural would that be? How selfish would that be? How misguided would that sound? Could I even dare say, how nauseating would that be? This is what complaint does. This is what ingratitude does. This is what unthankfulness does to us, doesn't it? This is how unthankful people begin viewing life. There's always an issue. There's always a person. There's always something seeking to harm them, not thinking of them, not considering them, not considering their spouse, not considering their kids, not considering them as a boss, not considering them as a worker, not considering them as a church member, not considering them as a pastor. And this is what happens when complaint starts to take hold of our thought process and shape our outlook. Like the way Mark Twain said it, he said it like this: don't complain and talk about all your problems. 80% of people don't care, and the other 20% think you deserve it. It's an accurate observation about the fruitlessness of complaining. I want us to look at three short verses this morning about this issue from Exodus. I'll just tell you personally, when I'm struggling with frustration, complaint, unthankfulness, I go back to chapter 15 and 16 here regularly in my life and read to be reminded, not only am I not alone in struggling, but also there is a remedy. I want you to look at Exodus chapter 16. There's three verses we want to read this morning. I'll read them aloud. You follow along. Exodus chapter number 16. Help if I was not in Genesis chapter 16. There we go. All right. And they, this is the children of Israel, the nation of Israel, took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. And on the 14th day of the second month, after their departing out of the land of Egypt, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel, everybody say the word out loud, what is it? Murmured. Murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said unto them, would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and we did eat bread to the full. For ye brought us forth into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger. Now somebody may say, well, I don't know if that's the way it was dramatically read or not. Well, we know it wasn't presented kindly because we know they were murmuring. So it's not like oh, shucks, you know. There was some emphasis here. There was some emotion here. There was some misguided passion here in what they are saying versus what they view God as, what they view Moses and Aaron as, and what they view their life before the wilderness as. And though supernaturally cared for by God, that had been their state, Israel's selfishness leads them to complain. If there's a truth to take away from these three verses this morning and help us as we think about 2025 into 2026, here's what it is. Complaining is a sin of selfish doubt against God's goodness. Complaining is a sin of selfish doubt against God's goodness. If you take time and read chapter 15, 16, really you can go all the way to 17 and 18, you're going to see this truth displayed over and over. And if you went into the book of Numbers, you'd find it again. Why? Because it is at the door of every human heart. So let's be helped this morning, myself, yourself, about moving from complaining to contentment, thankfulness, gratitude. Let's learn a few truths about complaining. First truth is this: complaining forgets God's provision in the past. Look at verse number one there. It gives us a bit of their journey. It says, and they journeyed from, and then starts detailing basically what's happened since they've left captivity in the land of Egypt and where they are at now on the verge of walking into the desert wilderness. But I want to remind us as we start here, God's still leading them, right? They're now going in the southeasterly direction there in the area of Egypt, and God's still leading them. He had just taken them through difficult situations through the Red Sea. He had just taken them to a spot where they had no water, and he turned bitter waters into miraculously sweet and wonderful waters provided for them out of nowhere, if we could say it that way. But now, just a day later, what? They're looking out on the horizon in the wilderness, and there's no speedways on the horizon. There are no Costcos on the horizon. And to the person focusing on the physical plane, they look out and all they see is a hopeless situation in front of them. God here is taking them to a place to continue to show they need dependence upon Him, not just what they can provide for their own selves. But how do they respond to this opportunity from God? Well, note what happens. Not even 50 miles into the journey, verse 2 shows us that not one, not two people, not a dozen people, not a few prominent families. It says the entire congregation. Now, we don't know exactly how many people this is, but we suspect, given the numbers, it's north of 1 million people that God is supernaturally caring for and providing for. Not 1 million people minimum get together, and what do they decide? I'm going to murmur. You guys know how that starts, right? One person starts, well, you know what would have been nice? And then what happens? Just starts to move, doesn't it? And they murmur. The idea of the word murmur here is complaining, grumbling, stopping your heart from following something or believing something is true. So they go from a place of God is good. He took care of us. We needed water. He gave us water miraculously to now. Well, what has He done for me lately? That was then. This is now. To be clear, they're not asking for clarification. This isn't them struggling with a difficult situation, but continuing in faith. This has become ingratitude fueled by self-centeredness. The tenor of their heart to love, follow, and obey God has shifted. Again, the tone is no longer, I trust you, God, though it's difficult to understand. It's, how could you, God? I certainly deserved better than this. So let's put this in perspective. If we start at the high end of the funnel here and think about what God has done the previous month, the previous 2 months, the previous 4 months, all the way to the top of the highest part of the funnel as we came to this moment right here, here's what it'd be. God has heard their cries of oppression in the beginning of the book of Exodus after 400 years of enslavement and captivity. He delivers Moses from certain death as a baby by Pharaoh's murderous decree. He even moves Moses into Pharaoh's house under his nose to be cared for by people of royal descent. He then also has Moses trained in their ways as he grows into an adult, as somebody who's supposed to be in the royal lineage, an outsider brought in and adopted. All that goes sideways when Moses misunderstands his purpose and he is banished to the desert. And that may be his death sentence if it weren't for God moving Moses into Jethro's house. It's there that God trains Moses for 40 years about what it is to be a deliverer of his people. He gives him the rod. He gives him Aaron. He grants the nation of Israel safety out of Egypt. He does so through miraculous plague after plague after plague that were all his long-suffering drawing to Pharaoh and Egypt to be reconciled to him as sinful creation. As Pharaoh says no to that, and they are delivered out of his hands miraculously, they go through the Red Sea with the water moved to the side and dry land, and they walk across with all the riches of Egypt on their backs through this dry land and water portal. They get to the other side of what happens, the mightiest army in the world at that time, destroyed, demolished by the power of Almighty God. If that were enough, he provides them water as they are in the middle of nowhere. So I want you to just get the idea here. God has not failed to be faithful to them. Not at all. He's been faithful, caring, merciful, and provisional. But oh, how quickly their memory has failed them. See, this is what happens to us. It's easy to read here and say, well, shame on them for forgetting all the goodies God had done for them, how good he's been to them continually, perpetually. But I think we all know deep inside each of us, that's what happens when we hit times of kind of a barrenness or difficulty or struggle in our life. We go from relying upon faith and trusting God's goodness as our context to help us in this present situation and starting to ask questions. Why me? Why now? Why not this person? Why not because of? Why would you do? Why wouldn't you? How could you? You see, faith relies on the character and the works of its creator. Thankfulness calls us to remember his care in the past to give contextualization to the present. They had a massive onroad of God's blessings to consider, and here they are murmuring. That could have broken the tunnel vision for them if they had taken the time to do so. See, gratitude and thankfulness do not make you live in some fairy tale land full of unrealistic ideas or fake lies that you're going to have to fake it to make it, as it were. No, it helps you live realistically because you choose to ground yourself in God's love and you choose to proactively recognize his care. All of us are prone to complain and be unthankful. I think about the anecdotal story that circulated around Andrew Carnegie's life. It can't be historically verified, but is well established, as it were. Andrew Carnegie was a multimillionaire back in his day, and he left $360+ million to charity when he died. He also then designated $1 million of that day and time's money to family members. And it's recorded that one of the family members, when the will was read, rather than celebrate what was done, was angry that he had only left them $1 million when he could have left them so much more. Put it in perspective, that'd be about $50, $55 million of today's money. And all they got was a measly $55 million. We hear that and we think, ugh. But we know the sentiment because we've done it before ourselves in a different way. Complaining forgets God's provision in the past. But then note it, complaining poisons our hearts towards people in our lives who exercise spiritual leadership. What happens? They're complaining. It's against God. But who do they highlight in verse 2? And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against God, because that's who they were really upset with. That's not how verse 2 reads, is it? It's against who? Moses and Aaron. Though it's been God's plan from the beginning, though it's been God's direction and care from the beginning, they take their dissatisfaction with God, who they can't see, and they focus it upon people that they can see, the physical manifestation or representation of God's leadership and care in their life. Now, before we go too much further, let's remember here that Moses and Aaron aren't here in the middle of the desert because that's what they had longed to do on their LinkedIn career ladder. They're not there saying, my exit strategy is, when I get to retirement, I'm going to lead a bunch of malcontents into the desert and waste 40 years of my life. That wasn't on their bucket list. What had happened? Earlier on in the book of Exodus, in chapter 3 and chapter 4, we find God doing what? Calling Moses to this role and this task. Moses being a little bit concerned and frightened and doubt-filled about it. So he shows him that he will give him Aaron, his brother, as an aid in the endeavor, and he will perform miraculous works through Aaron and through him as Moses. So God ordains this position for these two men, and this is what happens in their lives. God uses them miraculously. They both serve tirelessly, and yet the people do what? Attack them because their circumstances aren't what they wish they were, and they're upset with God. When we're doing poorly in our thankfulness to God, we're prone to become easily suspicious of the leaders in our life and reimagine narratives involving them. Now, for Christians in the room, you already think, Pastor, you're softballing it up so you can just exonerate every pastor ever in our lives and just come after us as terrible church members. No, no, let's be clear. God puts more than just pastors in our lives as spiritual leaders, right? When you were young, your mom and dad were supposed to be that role. Brothers and sisters in the church that are older than you, Titus chapter 2, they take on that role. Yes, pastors even serve in that role. But even deacons as older brothers in the faith, they serve in that role. There's no shortage of people God puts into our life to help us with spiritual guidance and spiritual leadership. But when we're doing poorly, we start to become suspicious and critical and reimagine narratives. We become critical of pastors, deacons, and older Christians that God has put into our life and our church life, and then maybe even larger in the family of God. And even some issues that may even be somewhat true that involve them, we fail to answer in an accountable way with scriptures, and we let emotions and circumstances just take us to the winds rather than be holy, be scriptural. Friends, Satan isn't dumb or naive. In this passage, he's not sitting back thinking, oh, how can I really, really wreck the nation of Israel early on? How can I make them kind of stumble and not really get going here? If only there was a tried and true method. He knows if I coax them enough through complaint and they don't answer that properly, they'll start to find somebody to blame on this earth. And they do. Satan's no dummy. He loves to create friction between God's spiritual leadership and the people that are around their life that he's called them to lead. How does he do that? Well, first, think about this. He loves to use pride to confuse the issue at hand when we're needing help. Meaning, when we go to God's leadership that he's put around our life, here in this passage, today in our lives as well, with a problem, when we're struggling with something, we're struggling to understand something, we're involved in something we shouldn't be involved in, or somebody notices about our life and they come and try to talk to us, encourage us, and help us and call us away from that, you know what happens? The devil comes and stokes us with these thoughts. How dare you? He gets our pride all sorts of worked up and gets it sideways in a hurry. As I've seen this far too often in my walk with Christ since I've been a Christian since I was 15, and then even as a pastor now, I've observed when God's doing something in someone's life to pull them towards growth in their sanctification, or to pull them away from something through correction about something hindering their sanctification, that if that individual, myself included, does not respond with submissiveness to Lord Jesus, guess what's waiting there to greet them? Resentment, anger, unthankfulness, bitterness, defiance, resistance, an aggressive attitude. And they start to hurt all the people that have loved them for years, people that have invested in them for years. Whether that's a young person with their parents, whether it's a grandparent trying to help a grandchild, whether it's an aunt or an uncle, whether it's a pastor or a deacon, maybe it's a brother or sister in the church, doesn't matter who it is. All of a sudden, they're the problem, and we don't want to submit to what Jesus has said is true for us, about us, and him. Satan's no dummy. He gets our pride to confuse the issue at hand that we really need help with and gets us kind of sidetracked on some other adventure that will take us nowhere. But second, he likes to use the truth that, guess what? All those people that are in your life, they're sinners too. How dare you talk to me about my this or that? I remember a time when... Every married person in the room's had that conversation, right? I remember when you said... And we like to pull out from the past, drag that chest of old dirty laundry and pull it out for the world to see so we can feel justified about what we're struggling with in the present that we don't want them to call us to accountability about. Brothers and sisters, help me. Let's remember what the Lord Jesus said in Matthew 5. What's the groundwork? What's the fertile soil of spiritual development in your life, in my life? What did Jesus say? Blessed are the, what is it? Poor in spirit. Need, spiritual dependency, spiritual poverty is the fertile soil through which God's grace works in my life and in your life as well. But when we become ungrateful, we become complaint-filled, it's a poison towards the Lord. It's shutting off the valve of grace practically in our life. And now what happens is the flesh's control starts to find somebody to take it out on. Whether that's somebody in your family, somebody in your church family, somebody in the family of God, until we become submissive about this matter to God, we're going to start finding a problem with everyone around us because that's what complaint does. Complaining forgets about God, his goodness, his care in the past, and then it starts poisoning our relationships with people who spiritually invest in us in the present. And then lastly this morning, complaining makes us unrealistic and unreasonable. It makes us unrealistic and unreasonable. Benjamin Franklin's famous for saying, contentment makes poor men rich, and discontentment makes rich men poor. Here in this passage, you see millions of people go from celebrating the care of God. Literally, if you just flip back to 15, they do a whole time of song and dance about it. I mean, song and dance. Half of us in this room have no idea what dancing is. I get it's a Baptist church. But that's how excited they were. I mean, they were so overwhelmed with the goodness and kindness of God that they are singing exuberant praise to God, extemporaneous praise to God. They're dancing, they're celebrating, they're excited. Listen, yesterday the Bears not only made the playoffs, but clinched. And there was stuff all over social media about Bears fans celebrating and rejoicing. Why? Because it's been forever since that's happened. You saw a bunch of grown men, you know, just all over social media, just random strangers screaming and yelling and high-fiving. Total people who have no idea who each other are, high-fiving, chest-bumping, yelling, screaming, probably a little alcohol involved there. But still, these people here were over the top, expressive about the care of God. But now because of complaint, the discontentment from within flowing without through complaint, well, nothing's right. Look at verse 3 with me again. If you're a familiar Bible reader, you know this verse. You've seen it. You've heard it. But it should never cease to shock us the absurdity of what's said here in this verse. Look at verse 3. And the children of Israel said unto Aaron and Moses, would to God we had what? Died. Wish we were just dead. They have these unspiritual desires. They're not seeing things biblically at this time because complaint has just choked it out. into a tunnel vision, temporal focus, and there's nothing right, nothing good in their lives, and they have these unspiritual desires. Would to God we had died. They begin their complaining by lamenting that God just hadn't killed them off in the land of Egypt. Now think about it. They're expressing that God would have killed them. Whether they're hearkening back and thinking of, I wish we had died in slavery, or whether they're saying, I wish we had died when the plagues were killing everybody else. That would have been better. That would have been more merciful of God if he had just killed us through slavery or the plagues. That's some backwards, confused thinking, isn't it? And these unreasonable desires. Put yourself there. What had the children of Israel groaned under and complained unto men, but also sought God and lament about for 400 years? God, deliver us from these oppressors. And God was gracious and merciful to do it. And now they're what? I wish we could go back. It was better. I wish we could go back and we could die there. Wouldn't that be better? That's not rational. It's not reasonable. But that's what complaining does to our brains and then to our relationships. It makes us unreasonable. It makes us irrational. We see everything as harmful to us and start to think of things that are harmful to us as not as harmful to us. These people had cried due to affliction their forefathers had, and now they're engaged in vain speech, even trying to attach God's name to it. When they say, would to God, is them trying to attach his name to what they think he should have done. It's them using his name in vain. God, let our will be done the way we expect it to be done, and you'll orchestrate it in that manner. It's as if they're invoking God right now to say or to do what they're asking him to do. Go ahead and kill us. Wish you'd just done it sooner. But that's not where it ends. They then exaggerate their conditions. As they continue their complaining rant, we find a telling characteristic about complaining in our lives. We always exaggerate plain complaining. What do they say there in verse number 3? Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. And here's how they shift and recreate a narrative in their mind. When we sat by the flesh pots and we did eat our bread to the full. They exaggerate their conditions, whether reflecting on the past, speaking of the present, looking to the future. Complaining always distorts and blows out of proportion what's taking place, has taken place, and it's inconsistent. In the past, they remember it being that they sat by the flesh pot. Somebody might say, what is that? Well, think of it like a three-legged pot that you would likely be boiling either meats or vegetables in the household. They talk about having bread to the full. In other words, they're saying, I remember back in the good old days in Egypt when we were in slavery, you know what we had? The full buffet. Every day when we got off of that hard day's work, we rolled up to the buffet and we got food as much as we wanted. There was meat, there were veggies, and because we were Jewish, they noted our kosher diet. That's what the Egyptians did for us. They gave us bread. We didn't fail to have a great meal when we were slaves in Egypt. If you're not familiar with the book of Exodus, that's about the most bizarre, 100% false narrative you can imagine. That's not how it was it? They were beat mercilessly. They were given more and more work in an unsustainable pace that they could never meet. They were given less and less food to be able to sustain themselves in all this grueling work. And so for them to say now in this unreasonable state of mind, did we have it better? I wish we had died as slaves. At least we were fat slaves. No, not staring at this, the empty abyss of sand in front of us. Unreasonable. Exaggerative. That's not how it happened. Their summation of the present is that they're certainly going to die. You brought us out here. There's only one future here in front of all of us is sand, and therefore it's hopelessness. We are going to die. It's not we might die. It's not, you know, barring God's intervention, it's looking pretty meek out here. It's loose, looking bad. It's we know to a certainty we're going to die. There's no hope because there absolutely can be no help. You have let us out here to have a mass execution. See, complainers embellish and exaggerate their condition to make their desires seem noble. In a lot of the counseling classes that I've taken, they talk about when you're counseling people to help them recognize when they're creating false narratives. And typically, one of the ways they do so is through exaggerative language. She always, he never, I always have to. Those are dead giveaways for falsehood. Those are dead giveaways for embellishment and exaggeration. Those are dead giveaways of narrative recreation. Here in the passage, they are saying such ridiculous, embellished, exaggerative claims because it blame shifts and justifies their actions. It's God's fault. It's Moses and Aaron's fault. Rather than, I just need to deal with my hunger and dependence upon the Lord and trust his faithfulness from the past, his provision from the past, the good leadership he's had in our lives to this point as we go forward together, trusting what God will do. It seems difficult. It seems ugly. It seems unrealistic to have any hope, but my hope's not grounded in what I see. It's grounded in who God is. But that's the problem with complaint. It focuses us on a temporary situation. They can't get past the idea that they're hungry. Not to beat a dead horse here, but God hasn't failed them yet, right? He's not failed them one time. He's been their miraculous provider. He's been their caring provider. He's been their merciful provider. So this is just a moment for them to what? Have some faith. See, complaint thrives in what it can see, what it can understand, and what it fears that you will never know or experience. That's where complaint thrives, rather than some faith. When I was younger, and when one of my older daughters was younger, she went with me to the bank. I was putting some money in the bank. And when I gave the money to the teller, she just got this look on her face. She seemed really nervous and scared. And I thought, I kind of noticed it. I thought, that's weird. We'll get out of the car. I wonder if something happened. Did she use the bathroom on herself? You know, you just, as a dad with a young kid in some public, you're like, what's going on here? Did she see something? Did somebody give her the eyeball? What's going on here? We get in the car and I ask, you okay? And she is almost in tears now. How are we going to buy food? It's like, what? What's going to happen? Why did they take your money? What? In her mind, me giving the bank our money, that we would not have any money. She didn't understand the transaction that had taken place. Because she didn't understand the transaction, and in her concern and her fearfulness, rather than ask, she just in her own mind starts what? Oh no, oh no, oh no. Whereas I had a better view and understanding of the situation. Friends, in simple illustration, remind us, we often are prone to get the tunnel vision about temporary circumstances and focus. And you get the, oh no, instead of remember, wait, this is a moment of dependence. This is a moment of reliance. This is a moment of faith. This is a moment to continue in obedience with the Lord and have some thankfulness in my faith. The complainers, they don't have that. You see here at the end of this verse, they seem to have consistent relationship problems. In the midst of all this complaining rant, as we've already said, who do they blame? Moses and Aaron. You brought us out here to die. We've covered it already a little bit about them being the appointed leadership. But again, their anger is not at Moses and Aaron. Their anger is at God. And though Moses and Aaron don't succumb to it, the people, through their hateful words, are willing to what? Hurt, or potentially, if they could, break off the relationship with Moses and Aaron, utilizing outrageous statements. You two are the problem. You two let us out here to die. Now, I want you to think. Is there any evidence or proof from Exodus 1 to chapter 16 where we're at here? If you're familiar with the Bible at all, is there any evidence that behind the scenes, that's what God and Moses and Aaron have been crafting the whole time? Would you love to think about asking one of the Israelites, what do you think happened to get you to this point?
Well, I'll tell you what I think happened.
I think God got sick of us asking to get out of Egypt. And so he brought Moses along, and he did all those really neat, cool things about the baby and the moat and going into Pharaoh's house to Jethro, coming back to the plagues. And I think he did all that. He said, Moses, I'll give you a lot of goodies, but you're going to have to go through some hard times. But I've got this plan to kill a few million people, and I want you to be part of it. Ooh, I like it. Aaron's my brother. Can he be in on the goodies too? Yes, he can. All right. And so then that's what God did. He decided to get these two guys to lead us out of Egypt and murder us out here in the sand through hunger and lack of water. That's the dumbest thing you've heard lately, right? But that's the idea they had. You let us out here to kill us. What a foolish, foolish statement. I understand. I struggle as a hangry individual. I don't know if you're like that. When I'm hangry, I have to just be quiet. Otherwise, I'm unkind. So I get it. Hunger's a real factor here. But to this extent, that Moses and Aaron, the one reason that they exist in this space and in this time in their lives is to take them out for a mass execution into the desert, I think they got better things to do with life. This was not what they planned on doing with the rest of their lives. But that's what complaint does. It breaks off relationships through bad narrative creation after bad narrative creation after bad narrative creation after bad narrative creation. And in their minds, they're 100% right and accurate. See, complaining makes us unrealistic and unreasonable towards God and with other people. You don't have to do it right now, but I would encourage you to think in your life, some of the severed relationships you have experienced that you can say you did not create or cause, and think about what part complaint, unthankfulness generated in that. What part that played in that. Sometimes we've been the primary one to do it. Other times it's been them. But complaint is what drives it. As I stated last week, we had a very weird, weird week. Sickness-wise, had a foster kid going in the hospital. And she was supposed to be discharged on a certain day, and I had to be there. So last Sunday was a very weird Sunday. I didn't come to church, which is like the weirdest thing in the world for me. I was like, I got up and I'm like, what do I do with my life today? I don't even know. I'm going to go sit in a hospital, which is great. I get to hold a baby. But I sat there waiting for her to get discharged, and that didn't enter. And so lunchtime came around. I went downstairs to the cafeteria, and Dayton Children's is not known for their cuisine. So I sat there, they ate a lukewarm burger with fries that I think may have been from Saturday. I can't vouch 100%, but that's what they tasted and felt like. So I ate this lukewarm burger with these mediocre at best fries. And I sat there, and I can honestly tell you, as I thought about, because your brain works, right? Well, this is not a great meal. But I sat there and thought about it for a minute too. God, thank you. I get to sit here in a hospital with care that maybe I haven't agreed on everything that they've done, but still excellent care, with a daughter who's alive that I get to, God willing, take home today, at that point I thought, or tomorrow. And yeah, I've got nothing but puking people at my household to take her home to, but I still have people at home to take her home to, right? What am I saying? The Lord just reminded me as I sat there, and then on top of that, I get comparison can be faulty at times. I looked around the room and I could tell, if you've ever been to a hospital enough, you can realize who's got kind of a mediocre situation and who's going through what seems to be a little bit more dire of a situation. I just sat there in the calf with my lukewarm burger and those nasty fries. And it wasn't a time of griping. It was a time of thankfulness. Also a time of grieving as I watched this young couple who obviously just had a baby and something's not right. And they, you can tell, have the eyes. You know what I'm talking about?
There's been some tears shed in that family.
I watched grandparents enter into the calf with other people who had obviously a kid in the hospital, and the sullen look on their face told me enough to know what? Something is not great in their family today. A comparison is faulty at a level, but it did what? It just helped remind me. There's a lot to be thankful for, more to be thankful for than what I want to do in complaint and criticism towards God and other people. My brothers and sisters, let's strive to let God help remove consistently complaining from our daily thought process and verbalization. Can I meddle for a second with parents? Stop creating victims with your children. Well, the school didn't do this to my kid. How dare they? Stop. Oh, my teacher's not really that good. Stop. I can't believe the church didn't get gluten, soy-free, vegan, milk-free, wheat-free, taste-free, calorie-free cookies for the children's ministry. Stop. I can't believe they didn't get us Fiji water in the foyer there. Stop. Parents, you create victims of your kids grounded in complaint, anger, and unthankfulness, and it is only harming them. Nobody owes you a thing. That's not the way to end this sermon, Pastor. Nobody owes you a thing. Nobody owes me a thing. It's of the Lord's grace we have our existence today. It's of the Lord Jesus' sustainment of the universe, Colossians 1, that you and I are even held together today. The only thing I really can say I deserve, that I've earned, we talked about on Christmas Eve, the only thing I do deserve is to be separated from God for forever. That's what I deserve. And in His mercy and His grace, He's made a way to not have to. Everything else is wrapped in His grace, wrapped in His care. Brothers and sisters, I want to encourage you today. 2025 probably did have some tough stuff. That's real. Not denying that. We probably had some stuff I made worse than it really was. 2026, we'll have some great moments. We'll likely have some moments that will call you to complain. Let's step back with the Lord's grace. Say, no, I'm going to have faith. Not selfish doubt about this. I'm going to let the Lord help me. I'm going to be reliant and dependent and let His grace work through my life. He has something to do in my life. He has something to do in the sphere of influence that He's put my life around, and that's what I'm going to do.